Well, I've never been to a royal parade, but I have seen them on television. Whenever royalty comes to town or goes to visit some charitable project, hundreds upon hundreds of adoring fans line the streets to cheer them on. Perhaps more recently, some of you remember the footage of Prince William and Kate's wedding, where tens of thousands of well-wishers turned up to celebrate that royal occasion. Whenever royalty is in town, it's worth celebrating. Many centuries before Jesus, an Old Testament prophet named Zechariah invited the church of his day to anticipate the greatest of all royal visitations. And for reasons we shall soon see, that royal visitation would be unrivaled in magnitude, matched with unrivaled cause for celebration. Unrivaled magnitude, unrivaled cause for celebration. So let's dig in to these verses. In verse 9, we're given details of the royal kingly visitation. But firstly, Zechariah wants to set the tone for the occasion. He wants you to get a feel for what's about to take place. And as he prophetically and eagerly anticipates the royal visitation, in his mind's eye, he says, rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout aloud, O daughter of Jerusalem. You know, even if we anticipate and appreciate nothing else about what Zechariah has just told us, surely you could concede that in those few words, he anticipates and expects a wonderfully great celebration on that day. But look more closely at the text with me. Look more closely. There is an easily overlooked detail that we have to address. The royal king is coming, we know this much, but the king is to be received by a daughter. The king is to be received by a daughter. O daughter of Zion, O daughter of Jerusalem. It turns out this king who's coming to visit is a parental king. He claims parental rights over those who receive him. And this may sound really strange to us. We are not familiar with parental kingship. We know of kings and queens who rule from their palaces and are often quite benevolent, especially in modern times. Kings and queens nowadays tend to be quite harmless and benevolent rulers. And for all their benevolence, for all their kind presentation in the media, we all know that there is an unbridgeable gap between common people and royalty. We all know this. Common people don't get to run into the royal kitchen and grab a biscuit at their leisure. Common people don't get to high-five the monarch. Common people don't get to doodle on royal letterheads. Or they all play hide-and-seek in the royal gardens. Common people don't get to do such things because there's a divide, there's a gap. But perhaps the children of royalty do get such privileges. Maybe the princes and princesses do get such privileges. They do get to doodle on the royal letterheads. They do get to run into the kitchen and grab something when they're feeling a little snackish. And that is what Zechariah is getting at here. When this kind of king comes, when the parental king comes, those who receive him will be treated like his very own children, not as subjects, as his own children. Why? This king, as the text says, is a parental king. He is to be received by his daughter. And I sure would like to know a king like that. I sure would like to know a king who would receive me as his own son. Further still, the fact that this daughter, this daughter ought to rejoice and shout gladly at the arrival of her father, the king, is telling. The daughter has to be the one shouting and shouting greatly at the coming of her fatherly king. You know, as you read the Old Testament, you'll see this phrase from time to time. You will come across the Bible speaking of God's people as his daughter, the daughter of Zion. And when you read that, when you read about the daughter of Zion or the daughter of Jerusalem, it sounds really warm and friendly to us. It sounds like it's the kind of family that's well bonded, that God could speak to his daughter this way. Well, not in Old Testament times. Not in Old Testament times. Most usually in the Old Testament, when you come across the phrase daughter of Zion, it is negative. She is not at peace with her fatherly king. She is wayward. She is rebelling. She is sinning. For instance, Isaiah 1 verse 8 describes her this way, "And the daughter of Zion is left like a besieged city." In Isaiah 52, she's described as a captive daughter. Again, in Lamentations 2, we hear this, "How the Lord in his anger has set the daughter of Zion under a cloud." The title, daughter of Zion, is most usually negative in the Old Testament. It speaks of her fractured relationship with her father. And yet here, cutting against the grain, here, Zechariah is calling on this daughter, calling on these people, pleading with her to receive her fatherly king with rejoicing and shouts of gladness. How could this be? This is because her fatherly king is intent on healing the fractured relationship. The fatherly king has come to make things right. He has set his heart upon reclaiming his own daughter. This is what the fatherly king is determined to do. And if this is what the fatherly king is intent on doing, it tells us an awful lot about what the king is actually like. What is this fatherly king really like? That he would come to heal the relationship between him and his wayward daughter. Well, it tells us something about his character, and Zechariah elaborates in verse 9. He tells us what this king is like. "Behold, your king is coming to you. Righteous and having salvation is he. Humble and mounted on a donkey, on a colt, the foal of a donkey." You know, if heaven had anything approximating a tabloid magazine, the tell-all blurb on the cover story would read something like this: "The fatherly king, the one who came for his wayward daughter to reconcile her to himself, is righteous and having salvation." That's what he's like. That's who he's like. That's what he is like. He has come to rescue, and he is righteous, having salvation. And we often tend to think of words like this in the Bible, righteous and salvation, as those big words that we could never understand. That's not how God intends them. God said those words in the Bible, knowing that ordinary, mere mortals like you and I are going to pick up that Bible and read it, trying to gain some understanding. In this way, one thing we can say about the fatherly king being righteous is that he always does what is right. To be righteous is to always do what is right. And God often expresses his righteousness, his rightness, in the real world. in the things that he does. Think about another prophet named Isaiah who anticipated the fatherly king doing what is right. Of the increase of his government and of peace, there will be no end. On the throne of David and over his kingdom, to establish it and uphold it with justice and with righteousness from this time forth and forevermore. The fatherly king does what is right as he governs, as he makes peace, as he brings justice, as he establishes his kingdom. In all those things, he does what is right. He is righteous to do so. And the daughter of Zion is to come to her senses and acknowledge that her fatherly king's character is righteous. The daughter is to come to her senses, stop being wayward, stop mucking around, stop sinning, stop rebelling. Come to your senses. Your fatherly king is righteous. And this righteousness is not a temporary play act for him. He's not putting on a show just to win over his daughter for a season. He's not bluffing. This is who he is. This is who he always is. It is characteristically him. He is right in his being all the time. And should such a truly and perfectly righteous fatherly king come to visit his wayward daughter, that would be cause enough for her to celebrate. The fact that this wonderful father would come and visit, that's cause to celebrate. But the fatherly king also comes having salvation. He's right to visit her, but he has not come just to visit. He has come having salvation. There's more to this fatherly king than simply righteous rulership. There is also redemption. The Old Testament is well-versed. If you read your Old Testament, it is well-versed in this human need for redemption. The Old Testament teaches us frequently about Israel and her need for salvation, showing the ugliness of her sin, which needed forgiving. But their salvation must come to her. Never miss this about the Old Testament. The salvation of God's people must come to her. They cannot find it themselves. They are not able to save themselves. The salvation must come to them. And this salvation is what their fatherly king is now bringing. He is coming to them. They're not going to go find him somewhere. He is coming with salvation. He is bringing their salvation to her. And when this fatherly king comes to Jerusalem, when he comes to his daughter, his people, his church, he is bringing you his salvation. That is to say, this fatherly king will reclaim his daughter. He will take her back to himself, into his very heart, into his very own affections. Such is the promise of the Christian gospel. The king will have you. He will have you. But when and where will this happen? When and where is this going to happen? Verse 9 says that the fatherly king is coming, and he's coming to Jerusalem, the ancient center of Jewish religious life. So Zechariah at least tells us what city to look at, where to keep our eye. Zechariah would have us keep our eye on that city, Jerusalem. Keep your eye there. But still, this leaves you somewhat in the dark, doesn't it? So you're supposed to look at Jerusalem, but then what? For how long? Imagine living 500 years before Jesus, in the time when Zechariah was writing, handing down this prophecy from one generation to another, keeping this watchful eye on Jerusalem, waiting and wondering, Who in the world will be this fatherly king? But fortunately, Zechariah pointed to another significant signpost. Look to Jerusalem, but also look for this. When you see someone in Jerusalem doing these kinds of righteous kingly things, when you see someone bringing righteous justice, giving sight to the blind, proclaiming good news of salvation, establishing his kingdom, when you see someone doing those things, hope and hope for more. Hope to see that man riding, entering Jerusalem, making his grand entrance upon Jerusalem on the back of a donkey. Because if that's happening, it's go time. The fatherly king has arrived, and it's time for you to receive him. To which the average punter would say, what's so special about riding a donkey? I mean, honestly, if this is this great fatherly king who's come to do mighty things, couldn't he ride something with a bit more pizzazz? Couldn't he enter Jerusalem on the back of, say, a tamed tiger or a Clydesdale at least? No, the donkey is key. The donkey is key. War kings arrive on horses. War kings come on horses. The fatherly king is not here to make war at this moment. He is here for his daughter. He is here to make peace with her. And for that, a humble donkey is the right animal for the task. He's not here on a war horse. He's here on a humble donkey because he's here to make peace. The animal is perfectly suited to his mission. And this is precisely the connection made in Matthew's gospel account. When Matthew recalls the kinds of things that had taken place in the days of Jesus, he says to us that Jesus' entry to Jerusalem on a donkey took place to fulfill what was spoken by the prophet Zechariah. It happened this way so that the prophet Zechariah might be fulfilled, so that everyone would get it, so that no mistakes would be left, would be made along the way, so that all the loose ends would be tied up. The fatherly king is here because he rode into Jerusalem on a donkey. He's the right guy. You're looking at the right person. The donkey helps us to pinpoint the truth that we Christians celebrate. Jesus is the fatherly king, the righteous king, the saving king, who came for his wayward daughter, his church. But this fatherly king has not just come to Jerusalem for a photo op. No, he's here for everlasting peace. He's here for everlasting peace. One of the things prophesied about the fatherly king's mission in Jerusalem is this: I will cut off the chariot from Ephraim and the war horse from Jerusalem, and the battle bow shall be cut off, and he shall speak peace to the nations. His rule shall be from sea to sea and from the river to the ends of the earth. That's his mission. And at this point, we must surely confess, we don't see this part of the prophecy fulfilled just yet. Or am I mistaken? Has the instruments of war to the north of Jerusalem been cut off? Has the battalions to the south been dismantled? No. We see wars throughout the world still. Even this very day, there is still a civil war raging in Yemen and Myanmar. There's a drug war in Mexico where hundreds are losing their lives. There's an ethnic war going on in South Sudan. And then the war that our news cycle seems to be obsessed with right now between Russia and the Western powers. So Zechariah's prophecy about the fatherly king making global peace is yet unfinished business. Even so, those events which took place in Jerusalem, the prophecy, the donkey, these things are central to the establishment of global peace under the rule of fatherly King Jesus. As Christians, we are convinced if Zechariah's prophecy was right about Jesus and the donkey, then the rest of the prophecy will surely follow. If he was right in verse 9, he's right in verse 10. You follow? And this includes, according to verse 10, the complete disarmament of all the king's enemies throughout the world, on every continent, in every city. Nothing less will do than for the fatherly King Jesus ruling from sea to sea. Nothing less will do. This is how Zechariah sees it. He, the fatherly king, Jesus, shall speak peace to the nations. His rule shall be from sea to sea and from the river to the ends of the earth. Zechariah expects, anticipates, and prophesies the global rulership of Jesus. Other prophets confirm the same thing to us. Isaiah said, of the increase of his government and of peace there will be no end. Habakkuk tells us, the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. It will be everywhere, every continent, every city submitted to the rulership of fatherly King Jesus. Jesus will rule from sea to sea. And this means that the future of Christianity is global Christianity. The future of Christianity is global Christianity. And her fatherly king will see to it. If this is the future that awaits the world, if Zechariah is true that from sea to sea is where Jesus will reign, if he is right, if that is true, if we are to believe that, my question to you this morning is simply this. What do you see in this prophecy of Zechariah? What do you see about this king? Do you see royalty? Do you see your fatherly king? I ask this question pointedly as I return to the original statement made by Zechariah. He says, behold your king. Your king is coming to you. Righteous and having salvation is he. The invitation by Zechariah here is not simply to see the Christian king. It's not even to see the king of the church. The invitation is to see the fatherly king, Jesus, as your king. See your king. See Christ. Will you have him? Will you receive him? Will you lay down your weapons of unbelief to him this morning? The fatherly king has come to redeem his people. He rode into Jerusalem some 2,000 years ago on a donkey, making peace through his crucifixion, disarming and rendering his enemies useless. He disarmed his enemies and he renders their weapons useless. 3 days later, he was raised from the dead and he took his seat as the rightful king over the nations. Our hope for global peace is found in him and him alone. Our hope for salvation is found in him and him alone. So will you have him? The fatherly king will surely have you.